Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome, welcome to this Thursday edition of Head On. Quite possibly Friday, depending on where you are on the globe. But for me, Thursday evening, early Thursday evening on the east coast of the U.S. in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful West Virginia. And it is a beautiful day. A beautiful day here as the day begins to fade away. And I've been trying to flush the toxins out of my system from yesterday evening. Trying to sort of get free of the general ickiness of knowing that the Senate of the United States sold the Constitution, and by extension, you and me, down the river yesterday. Traded our birthright for their thin bowl of gruel. And I gotta tell you, it's still not sitting very well. I take some comfort in knowing what Dennis Kucinich announced today and what he will introduce or has introduced in the House of Representatives as a privileged resolution today, a single count of impeachment against George W. Bush. It is at least moderately interesting that Nancy impeachment is off the table. Pelosi has said that
The Judiciary Committee may hold some hearings on Congressman Kucinich's resolution.
When you're dealing with this manifestation of the Democratic majority in Congress, you got to take your optimism where you can doggone well find it. And that's as close as I can get this evening. George Bush, on the other hand, has flown away from the G8 summit, but not before doing something in typical Bush fashion. I'm trying to think of just exactly where it is that you can see that picture, that video of George, I guess when he was governor of Texas, shooting the bird at the TV camera prior to some sort of an address, or maybe it was after he got the presidency. No, I think it was when he was governor of Texas, because he looked like a slightly younger idiot at the time. And he's done it again. Leaving the G8 summit, you know, that big fraternity party that he went to where they had, what was it, horny-headed leprosy hand fish soup or something like that? Really. While they were discussing hunger. Leaving Japan, George, who yesterday yelled when he saw Silvio Berlusconi, "Amigo,
Amigo! Hey, Silvio! What are you doing, buddy?
Thereby once, and oddly enough, that audio's just disappeared. Our chat room moderator and all around the horn person with whom we could not get along, ELO, has scoured the inner tubes looking for that audio because it was said in front of an open mic. But down the memory hole of George hollering, Amigo! Well, he did it again on the way out. He was getting ready to leave the G8 summit there at, I keep wanting to say Lake Toyota, but it's not Lake Toyota. And it's on the island of Hokkaido. But he was getting ready to leave. And he looked at the other leaders, the 7 out of 8, and said, Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. He made the joke in the summit's closing session. Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. It's being characterized as a private joke. And then he gave a terrorist fist pump into the air while he grinned, having said it. It's probably a little early for John Fox, our resident environmentalist, on-air environmentalist, to be in the chat room or be listening. So it's just as well. Maybe I'll have to mention it to him on the horn section this evening, because then we can hear that Doppler effect of what happens when John Fox goes screaming around the studio, unable to control himself. Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. That's the thing. He thinks it's a joke. He thinks destroying the planet is a big joke because it's all just a big fraternity party for him. He's delivering a pledge paddle spanking to the other members of the G8. Because, see, when he said it, according to the reportage, when he said it, when he did his terrorist fist pump, Gordon Brown and Nicolas Sarkozy just stood there looking at him with that cow looking at a new gate thing going in their eyes and their mouths hanging open, catching flies going, that little pea-brained, pig-eyed, jug-eared little lout did not just say that. I don't know how that comes up. I don't know how that comes off in French, but I can well imagine Gordon, what it sounds like coming out of Gordon Brown's mouth. You can well, Nicolas Sacre-Iliac. You need deep pass, whatever. Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. I won't be back. This is my last one, you little. The reporting coming from the Independent of the UK says President Bush made the private joke in the summit's closing session. Senior sources said yesterday his remarks were taken as a two-fingered salute from the president from Texas who is wedded to the oil industry. And you know what? The right-wingers just love it. They're just having a ball over it. They're so proud of George Bush. There's a right-wing blog out there, Escreed. Don't go to it. Don't give this freak any more traffic. Called the Gateway Pundit. And he says, Hooray! Bush gives global warming religionists the finger. Goes on to say, Not only has U.S. President George W. Bush saved Iraq and the Middle East from total annihilation with his successful 2007 troop surge, and not only has U.S. President George W. Bush saved hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghans from two of the most brutal regimes in history, not only has U.S. President George W. Bush brought democracy and freedom to the Middle East and Southern Asia, not only has U.S. President George W. Bush protected the American homeland after the worst attack in U.S. history, but now U.S. President George W. Bush just saved the U.S. economy from the global warming religionists. And then pointed out the fact that he was actually wrong. He's not the world's biggest polluter, that China owns that now, which maybe they do. So, where does that leave us in mid-2008? Apparently, whoever this creepy blogger is, the Gateway Pundit, apparently he's one of those dead-enders from the 20% crowd. This horse's ass actually thinks that Bush saved Iraq and the Middle East from total annihilation. Who was totally annihilating the Middle East? That seems to be what we're doing, isn't it? Saved hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghans from two of the most brutal regimes in history. Well, give or take a million that he got killed, I mean, you know. But these are right-wingers. They're not very smart people. And they're really, really not... They don't do that whole shades of gray thing. George Bush is a great friend to Jeebus because he done attacked Saddam Hussein and because, you know, Saddam tried to kill my daddy. You got to love that terrorist fist pump, too. Hey, goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. Tough way to start the show. Sorry. But that's, yeah, no kidding. Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. Here in the hills, we don't take too kindly to that. Because his pollutant buddies, you know, Arch Coal, Peabody Energy, Massey Energy, they're literally at war with my family and hundreds of other families over seams of coal that maybe aren't 6 inches thick. Holy cow. And he's proud of it. I wonder if he'd do his little terrorist fist pump here in southern West Virginia and say, hey, I'm proud to be the world's biggest polluter. How you like that sludge dam there, you little elementary schoolers there at Marsh Fork? How you liking that? Breathe some more coal dust, you little hillbillies. Is there any reason for me not to despise the very air that this pea-brained, pig-eyed, jug-eared little lout breathes? He seems to have forgotten that he is... Oh, my liver's quivering. He seems to have forgotten that he is the embodiment of the United States when he goes abroad. And that he has no business saying junk like this. Hooray! By the way, the right-winger spells hooray, H-O-R-R-A-Y. Hooray! Bush gives global warming religionists the finger. So let me see if I've got this straight. The right wing has decided that being concerned about the future of the planet is now a religion, but that it's a religion that they don't have to have any respect for. On the other hand, if I point out that His Holiness, the former Nazi anti-aircraft gunner, presides over a church that rapes little boys, well, I'm not showing sufficient respect. Or if I point out any of the depredations
of the right-wing Protestant religion industry. I'm just a hater. Got it. Double standard. Thy name is Repiglickin. You know what I mean? So that's a starting place. And, of course, there's that story I mentioned last night of the woman at the library in Denver who had the sign that said, McCain equals Bush, and she got arrested for it. No matter, and I guess truth is not an absolute defense, huh? So what a way to get started. Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. Uncle Dick's going to be so proud of me for saying that. Meanwhile, his backrub buddy, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, has decided to tell Barack Obama that he has no business giving a speech in Germany. Really? Barack Obama has sought, and apparently been granted, permission to give an address at the foot of the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. Angela Merkel, Bush's back rub pal, the woman with the creepy expression on his face when he was doing that grope, she says that it is not proper. This is not proper that he would do such a thing. No, really, I wish I was kidding. I'm not. And, of course, other German officials have said, wait a minute. The permission's already been given because it's not for Angela Merkel to make the call. She said, it is unusual to do actual electioneering abroad. She said that through her spokesperson, Thomas Stegg. It is unusual to hold election rallies abroad. No German candidate for high office would even think of using the National Mall in Washington or Red Square in Moscow for a rally because it would not be seen as appropriate. So it's inappropriate. Funny, they didn't feel that way when JFK stood there and said, Ich bin ein Berliner. And maybe that's why Obama wants to give the speech there. Fine by me. Then there's Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier, who said that Merkel's off-the-cuff remarks could be taken as a sort of a slam against the U.S. He said, the Americans contributed decisively to saving the city of Berlin, and that is why we should make historic sites such as the Brandenburg Gate available to them. If Barack Obama decides to take a trip to Europe and to visit Berlin as well as Britain and France, then we should warmly welcome it. We should see his desire to visit as a sign of the importance that transatlantic ties have for him and react positively. The foreign minister does not find it odd. Then they also said that John McCain would be welcome, too. Well, it's hospitable enough. But if you put John McCain in the same place where Barack Obama has given a speech, it's not gonna compare real well. Not at all. But loyal to the end, Angela Merkel, I don't know, maybe she wants another back rub. What do you think? Could that be it? And by the way, from the Magic 8-Ball Department, a few months back when the whole stimulus thing came out, I said that America would not stimulate the American economy, that they would instead go to Walmart and buy a bunch of cheap Chinese crap. Well, I was right. Headline from CNN Money. Shoppers stimulate discount stores. Walmart and Costco post strong June sales as consumers seek to get the most from one-time government payments
Performance from clothing retails was mixed. Yeah. No kidding. Walmart Stores, Inc. trounced analyst expectations Thursday with a 5.8% jump in June sales for stores open at least 1 year. The world's number one retailer raised its earnings guidance for the second quarter ending this month. They had analysts that expected a 3.8% jump, and it turned out to be a 5.8% jump. So guess what, taxpayers of America? You just gave Walmart a little bit more corporate welfare. Well, hot diggity damn. Don't you feel better now? Can't you just feel the economy beginning to strengthen? Makes me a little bit sick. Many thanks to those of you who did share your stimulus with the Horn, because you did stimulate the economy. Because in turn, we were able to take care of the stuff that keeps the Horn going. It helped us, among other things, keep our substantial bill paid with our friends at CityNet. And CityNet is a West Virginia, which, last I checked, is still at least nominally a part of the United States of America, notwithstanding the war that's being waged on us. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you very, very much. I got an email today from someone talking about, and I will guard their anonymity, about the stimulus check. Our writer says, we were supposed to get $1,200. According to Wall Street Journal descriptions of the checks the first month they were described, anyone who paid $500 or more on their joint return for last year qualified. Of course, we paid $500 and some change. So when we got our check letter, it said they changed the rules and it was now $600 that you had to pay for the year, upping the ante to $100. We failed the test and got $600 instead of $1,200. How did we spend it? $480 to the endodontist to stop a toothache. That's the average for a procedure that's supposed to be 80% covered. $98.70 to fill the truck's gas tanks. And that's it. A tank of gas and a trip to the dentist. Nice, huh? Our writer says. You think that'll stimulate the economy? And then adds, so, Bob, I'd planned on sending you some of our stimulus. It didn't work out, so I kicked in $75 on my credit card and said to myself, screw it. What's another $75 when you're $8,900 in debt? And that phrase that we got from Reverbo the other night keeps reverboing through my brain. Take it personal. Take it personal. I can't imagine that any of you got your stimulus checks and went running out to Wally World. But apparently a whole bunch of America did. And while I take a positively New Testament, not, you know, all that St. Paul foolishness, but a real Yeshua-centered approach, I take that view of helping out your fellow man. You know, if you've done it unto the least of these, you've done it also unto me. If you've not done it unto the least of these, you've not done it unto me, that kind of thing. In other words, how you treat your fellow man is how you're treating Jesus. I take that to heart. I don't think you have to take in all the magic crackers and the hooey and foofra to get the notion that that's a darn good way to go about living. And you don't have to say that you've got a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. No, it's just a good way to live. Because you know what? It's not a foreign notion. It's a notion that can be found in Hinduism. It's a notion that can be found in Buddhism. It's a notion that can be found in Islam. At the base level of just about every religion on earth is this notion that if we take care of each other, everything will be considerably better. So, you know,
No, but you know, if you've done it under the least of these Walmarts, no, that's not how it reads. But that's what we did. That is what America did. We got a little check, which was an advance on next year's. There wasn't any free money, baby. Tanstoffel, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. And we ran off to Walmart. America ran off to Walmart and gave Walmart some corporate welfare. Makes my liver quiver. It really, really does. Great way to start the show today, Bob. It means it can only get better in the next 2.5 hours. This does not mean I'm not stinking right now. I'm stinking up the joint right now, am I? No, I'm kidding. Marty says, I guess Angela Merkel is upset that Obama won't touch her. Hey. Yeah. Cossack says, remember Aberfan Wales. Yeah. And I pray to the extent that I pray that someday we don't wind up saying things like Aberfan and Marsh Fork in the same breath. Remember Buffalo Creek.
Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter. You see me, I'm doing my terrorist fist pump. Who? Ha ha.
Oh God. Yeah, here we go. Now, this could be one of those nights on the roller coaster. But you know, how many of them aren't?
Hi there.
Hey Susan, what's up, dear?
Well, I'm looking at a Huffington Post article headline report. Bush privately told Germany he had misgivings about Obama's speech.
No, really?
Yeah, according to the newspaper, a German newspaper reported this week that a member of the Bush delegation approached Merkel's foreign policy advisor, Christopher Heuksen, at the G8 summit in Japan to discuss misgivings about Obama's planned speech. The government is also acting out of respect for presidential candidate McCain, who has long enjoyed strong ties to Germany and good personal relationships with a number of...
Really? What? John McCain crashed a jet there, too?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, this is getting... How, you know what? I'm not surprised. You're not surprised, are you? The
no.
Fix, oh, I'll be damned. The fix was in all the time.
Yep.
Hey, Angela, honey, I just wanted to let you know that the boss over there says that if you don't inveigh against Obama giving a speech at the Brandenburg Gate, he's going to give you another back rub, baby. Now, what do you want to do? I mean, you can hear it happening, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Maybe the German government should reconsider, because Obama will be elected. You don't want to piss off the next president of the United States.
That's the whole thing about getting rid of the Bush administration and getting rid of Bush Beta 2.0, or whatever we're calling McCain these days,
yeah,
is to restore the world's respect for the United States. And there's Angela Merkel running backwards. Wonder how long it is before the German people get shed of her.
Posted in to, PPM's Greg Sargent commented on this post, and it says, quote, if Bush officials are privately trying to nix a speech that would give Obama a major boost, it's an interesting development and raises more questions, such as whether the administration is possibly letting efforts to help McCain intrude on back-channel diplomacy in other areas, unquote. Yeah. Wonderful thought.
Well, look, why are we... He's going to screw up, and we've said this all along. I've said it. You've said it. Everybody who listens to this program knows that the last year of this Bush administration has been a dedicated effort to screw up as much as humanly possible for the next occupant of the White House, because they fully expect it to be Barack Obama. At one point, they expected it to be Hillary Clinton. I think Flush Flimball is probably still not over the fact that he's not going to have Hillary to ride for 4 or 8 years, because he's been salivating over that since 1992.
Yeah, the poor baby. He's got such a rough life.
I know.
On another point, by the way, dear old Senator Graham's remarks, was appalling remarks. I know McCain has distanced himself from them, but initially he stood up for him, which should say something right there.
Yeah, I know. But no. We're far too wrapped up in, I've got this in the stack, and I guess this is just a tease, but we're far too wrapped up in Obama suggesting that American children learn a foreign language.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't get a chance to mention this last night. You know, the whole FISA thing.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my whole take on it.
All right.
Since when did reverence for the Constitution and the Bill of Rights become the purview of the wild-eyed left?
Elaborate, please.
If you listen to the mainstream media, the for-profit media,
yes,
you hear about...
Oh, yeah. Okay, I get it now. Yeah. Well, the only people... it's just a bunch of leftists.
Yeah, just all the people on the left screaming about it, about this, you know, Fourth Amendment thing. Guys, it's your Constitution, too.
They don't care. They don't like it very much, though. Because they're Tories. The right wing are Tories. They're the same people that didn't want independence from Great Britain 232 years ago. Conservatives is conservatives is conservatives is conservatives.
And idiots.
Is idiots is idiots is idiots. Absolutely. Disloyal, appeasers, backstabbers will turn on their very own country in a heartbeat. That's the very textbook of definition. Textbook definition. And that's why Samuel Adams, I believe it was. Yeah, let me just pull this up real quick. That's why Samuel Adams said what he did. Oh, there you go. If you love wealth better than liberty. Get that, Susan? If you love wealth better than liberty. The tranquility of servitude better than the animating contest of freedom. Go home from us in peace. We ask not your counsels or arms. Crouch down and lick the hands with which feed you. May your chains set lightly upon you, and may posterity forget that you are our countrymen. And I say that to any right-wing conservative. Because Samuel Adams was right. The tranquility of servitude. You know, how many times has it been said that it's easy to live in fascism? All you got to do is keep your head down and hope they don't come for you next. Enjoy the spectacle. Enjoy the shows. Sit around. Listen to Lee Greenwood sing, and I'm proud to be an American every so often. And just exist. In other words, the tranquility of servitude. Because I've got it in my head, Susan,
that what we have going here is an absolute manifestation of what Samuel Adams was talking about when he said the animating contest of freedom. What does it mean to be free? What does it mean to try to keep our liberty in some semblance of preservation? Susan? Ah, I bet I lost you. I bet that's you.
You did. Sorry about that.
Well, you know, it says something about me when I'm prattling on and I can't even tell I've lost a collar. It may be time for me to take a night off.
No. Actually, it's probably my voice over IP, or it's the dear boys at the, listening in. They got overeager and hit the wrong button and cut us off.
You know, I think Agent Fred enjoys our show. I was emailing with somebody earlier today, and I said, I said the same thing about the email conversations that I have going through the day with folks who listen to the program. And I said, I really bet Agent Fred enjoys the emails, the program, everything, because, you know, monitoring a whole bunch of, oh, my God, I saw him outside the movie theater, and he was so cute, LOLIMHOWTF. That's got to get really boring. And in America, how often do you actually get people emailing or conversing over the inner tubes who are actually talking about stuff that matters in the country? I have no doubt. I have no doubt that in the bowels of the National Security Administration, they probably get out they probably pop the microwave popcorn, get a few soft drinks out, and put their feet up on the console and sit back and listen every night. So hi guys, welcome to patriotism. When are you going to quit your stinking job spying on America and join the rest of us?
Yeah, when are you going to stop being whores and pimps and join the rest of the human race? Let's face it, at least a whore she practices an honest profession.
The world's oldest and the world's most honest. Yes, indeedy.
Yeah. They give value for what they get. I can't say much for the pimps.
Yeah, nine times out of ten, the problem's the pimps and the Johns. You know.
Yeah.
Oh, honey, I only went to the strip club because they were having drink bargains.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, honey, then why's your wallet full of $1 bills? Well, that's how they give change. I mean, those poor girls. Now, there's some truth in that. The girls who work at the dance clubs, a lot of them don't make very much. And the dance clubs actually have it over on them, because they make them pay for the stage time and where they do the pole dancing. They only make the money on the lap dances and stuff. How did I find out? I've been there.
Why, Bob?
Yeah. Why, Bob? Why, Bob? Well, because the bachelor party was there.
Oh.
But, of course, you know me. I got to talk to people, so... You know, I sit down and find out I'm not going to say the ins and the outs. I sit down and find out the whys and wherefores of how the business works, and I walk out of there going, Jesus, yeah. I mean, and I'm a smoker, and these places are just full of smoke, and even I walk out with my throat closing up and my eyes watering, and how do I know? Come on. I was organizing. That's what I was doing. I was campaigning, actually.
And here I hear I was, oh my God, Mitch McConnell, does he ever have a bad comb over? I just ran across a picture of him on the web.
Now, why is it that talking about strip joints reminds you of some of Republicans with bad comb overs? That's a question that could take hours, Susan.
Because they're regular patrons and they won't admit it.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Susan, it's a blast talking to you this evening, dear. Sorry I lost you the first time.
One piece of information that will cheer you up.
Yes.
Mitch McChinless is in trouble. We may not have to put up with him anymore.
Electorally, yes. We've got some listeners in Kentucky, including our buddy Dennis, And he confirmed the same thing to me. So they're doing their part to try to get rid of the most hateful man in the United States Senate.
Nice thought. Nice thought.
Yes, it is. That's one of those happy ones.
Give my love to Agnes.
Sure will. They're off at the summer reading program at the library right now, so I will when they return.
All alone.
Yep, true. Exactly. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
See you, Susan. Bye. That's our news ninja, Susan, calling from Columbia City, Oregon. Email rolling in regarding the whole Brandenburg Gate speech fiasco. Caroline Kennedy setting up another Camelot, Mile High Stadium, then on to Germany. Actually, it's the other way around. On to Germany, then Mile High Stadium. She says, girls got ovaries, you got to say that. And then, ew, spooky. Stimulus check, what did you do with your stimulus check? My stimulus check went to, one, this isn't me, this is an email. My stimulus check went to, one, the mechanic to get to clear a check engine light and smog test my car, two, pay my car's registration, and three, buy some nearly $4 a gallon gas. And then, have you heard what Phil Graham said about us being whiners? Yeah, I did. That, I think, was the last aneurysm of last night's show. I ought not joke about aneurysms. That's messing with karma. Yeah, that's what we are, we're whiners. Because we want America to be America again, we're whining about it. We have a mental recession. And it's real interesting to follow the progress of the comment, because originally the McCain-Churian candidates, Flax and Flappers, said, Mr. Graham was simply saying that we are laying out the economic plan this week. The plan is comprehensive, providing immediate near-term relief for Americans hurting today, as well as longer-term solutions to get our economy back on track, secure our energy future, and deliver jobs, prosperity, and opportunity for the next generation. We're laying out that plan this week with an emphasis on the critical importance of job creation, and it's been a great success so far. And then Graham said to the Washington Post, of telling America that it's a bunch of damn whiners, I'm not going to retract any of it. Every word I said was true. And then he went on CNN. Somebody needs to tell Phil Graham about the first law of holes. When you're in one, stop digging. He said he didn't mean the American people were whiners, and he didn't mean it. He says it really is a mental recession. This is all in our heads. He said, the whiners are the leaders. Hell, the American people are victims. Wait, what happened to that complaint? Oh, dear God, is he saying that we've got a victim mentality? How many years have I heard the right wing complaining, oh, America, we've got a victim, we're a victim society. My friends, we're all victims. We don't stand up and take part in the capitalist miracle. We've got a victim mindset. Yeah, you've heard it, so have I. Graham said the whiners are the leaders. Hell, the American people are victims. But it didn't quite come out that way in the story. He said that the national leaders blame speculators and oil companies for our problems instead of presenting concrete programs for using energy more efficiently, or leaders who don't think we can compete with Mexico. I'm telling you, Phil, stop digging. Really. It's getting a little embarrassing. So, yeah, there's that too. Whiners. You bunch of whiners! Quit whining! What, you wanted more stimulus? All right, you're whiners and beggars. How's that? There's some more of that compassionate repiglickinism for you. Doesn't it feel good going down, or in, or wherever? Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, Juanita, how are you, dear?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm getting along, I reckon. A little warm here today.
It's very warm here, too.
Well, yeah.
Did you hear Guy James today?
Part of it, not all of it.
Did you hear what he said about, about John McCain?
No, no. But you know what? Any time the word McCain comes out of Guy James's mouth, I know it's going to be a thing of beauty.
He's just like a warmed over, I forgot the name of the guy. What was the guy that was on Law and Order?
Oh, warmed over Fred Thompson?
Yeah.
I didn't know you could warm over Fred Thompson. I thought Fred Thompson was pretty nigh unto dead.
That was so funny. Maybe it was something like that. Not exactly, but I just thought it was funny what he said. Oh, goodness.
I thought you were going to say that Guy James said John McCain was frosty dog poo, but that's too class. That's too low class for a guy. Guys. I'll say that John McCain is frosty dog poo. How's that?
He's whatever. Did you hear about him being questioned by a Vietnam veteran?
Yeah, I did. I saw that. I hadn't touched on it.
Yeah. So you've already read it?
No. I haven't said anything about it on air. No.
Yeah, well, I'll wait for you to say it.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure I can do it that good. But anyway, he said, let this veteran ask me a question. And the guy is asking him, why was he not voting to help the veterans out? And he kept doing like Bush. He kept saying the same thing over and over. He said, every veterans group in the country is giving me top grades. You know, for what I've done.
Yeah, he wouldn't answer the question, in other words.
Right.
My friend, I've been endorsed by every veterans organization in the country.
And the guy said, well, I happen to know, I think the VFW and some place else said they don't feel that way. That's where they took the vote. And then he started again, you know, just like Bush is always saying, the enemies, you know, the people that want to kill us.
9/11, dear leader. 9/11, citizen.
Yeah. But anyway, I thought, well, he's, and then he said, the guy, you know, and then he started talking about why he didn't back the education thing that he had. And he said, what I wanted to do was to offer it to the troops' family instead of, you know, them getting out too early. You know, he said it make people get out too early when they could give it to their children or to their wife. And he claimed that that's what happened. But he said it wasn't good enough because it didn't go back beyond, I think he said, 07. And I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, if John McCain said it, you can almost go to the bank on the fact that it's not true.
Yeah.
Truth ain't in him. You've got to remember that one.
Then he said, I'm not going to be talking about veterans' rights. He said, I'm just not going to be talking about that one. Well, what's he supposed to talk about? I mean, I watched that, it had a video on there, and I watched that.
Yeah.
So. But I've seen him, too, you know, where he was heckled over July the 4th. And he just didn't seem to know how to take it.
He doesn't know how to take very much at all.
Yeah.
Again, and this is the thing, this is maybe where we're missing the boat. He's not a very smart man.
Oh, and he said, we've already got the Social Security taken care of. They'll just have to vote for it.
Oh, and, yeah, on the horn section last night, I was talking with Peter Godbold about the fact that he says, well, you know, everything's on the table in terms of Social Security reform. And then they said, well, what about raising the cap on Social Security? No, not for that. That's not on the table. You know, so anything that would actually make wealthier America pay its fair share of the burden, that's not on the table. Because think about this, Juanita. I mean, you've worked in your day, and we've all worked jobs here and there, and some of us longer than others, and more successfully, less successfully.
And I've been typically American at times too.
You mean you've held down? You've been uniquely American where you've held down three jobs at one time.
Jobs, yeah.
That's uniquely American, Juanita.
Right. Uh huh.
Just makes you feel so good. You want to go out and salute something. I know. But if you think about it, though, there's not a floor
There's not an earnings floor for Social Security withholding. And the example that I used last night talking with Peter Godbold was that when I started working for minimum wage at the radio station as a teenager, they took Social Security out of the first hour that I made a wage, and the second hour, and the third hour, and it didn't make matter that I didn't make $8,000 a year or whatever.
No, no.
They were getting the Social Security out of it.
Of course.
So there's no floor, but at $80,000, the federal government says, Mr. and Mrs. Howell, you don't have to pay Social Security above $80,000.
Yeah.
How dumb is that? This is a social safety net. There's no guarantee that just because you make more than $80,000 this year, you're going to make more than $80,000 every year.
That's right. That's right.
Why shouldn't the government take Social Security out of earnings for every dollar you make?
Yeah.
If you're a millionaire, you get if you make $1 million a year, Juanita, you get a $920,000 a year tax break on Social Security.
Right.
I'm no economist. That's Mark Levine's job, and glad I am that it is. But I'll bet you we could go a long way toward fixing a lot of Social Security just by removing the cap.
But
see, there I go falling into the right wing's little talking point. Social Security isn't broke. It's not broken. It's not damaged.
Right.
I mean, there's John McCain saying, it's broke. We got to fix it. We got to fix
it,
my friend.
They're trying their best to break it.
And that's because the Republican Party, and you know this as well as I do, the Republican Party has hated Social Security from the moment it passed.
Yeah.
I can't say often enough that when Social Security passed in the Congress of the United States during the Roosevelt administration, the FDR administration, Social Security passed without a single Republican vote in favor.
And have you ever seen the footage on what Roosevelt went through? I mean, I saw, you know, the documentary about what he went through to get Social Security in. He just had to fight every step of the way.
I imagine he did.
And the man was already, you know, he didn't live. He was about like 63 when he died.
Isn't that amazing? He was what we would term a young man, and he looked ancient.
Yeah.
Of course, polio will do that to you.
Oh, yeah. And... Well, speaking of him, what a courageous person, because he trained himself with his son's help to walk straight, you know, to hold on to him and to walk straight. The man was in agony and did all of that. I mean...
A lot more guts than any Bush ever showed, didn't it?
And not to complain. I mean, what a wonderful guy. I mean, but anyway, And Nancy Pelosi, I don't know what, she was had a press conference today.
Mm-hmm.
But the other guy, the other Blue Dog leader.
Oh, Hoyer?
Yeah. He did most of the talking. But I didn't much pay attention to it. I don't know, I'm so disgusted with most of them. But, And another thing I wanted to say that I didn't say, maybe I'll get it out about Nancy Pelosi. You know, when I said I sent that email to her, and they said that since she didn't represent me, that I had to send it to their address.
Right.
Well, I know what they were talking about because I don't live in California where she's.
Right. You're not a member of her district, her constituency.
Isn't she supposed to represent me as a leader of the House, Speaker of the House?
Well, there's that, Juanita, and there's the fact that. That district in California does not pay her salary. You do.
Yeah, that's right.
Every member of Congress, every member of the House, every member of the Senate, the Supreme Court, the executive branch are all paid out of the funds that we commonly pay in taxes.
Yeah.
And it's not just Nancy Pelosi. It's a whole lot of members of Congress. They want to know, you know, before they'll even accept your email, that you've got to give them an address inside their district, or else it won't go.
And of course, I never heard from the last one. But But I thought, well, as Speaker of the House, surely she's representing all of us.
And she, or misrepresenting, as the case
may be. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I was really proud of her when that first started. I know a lot of people have been, you know.
Yeah, proud to see the first woman Speaker of the House.
And you know, she could do some good talking. But talking is cheap.
Yeah, it is. It's very cheap.
Talking is cheap.
In Washington, D.C., there are two things that are very, very cheap. Talk and life.
Talk and what?
Life. Life is cheap.
Yeah.
And when you can sit around and talk about indiscriminately slaughtering the Iranian people over mm-hmm. something that you don't even know to be true.
Yeah,
talk is cheap and so is life.
That's right. That's it. Especially to them. But,
yeah.
Anyway, that I kind of lose. Oh, I'll tell you what was on the View. I saw they were talking about Jesse Jackson and his little saying, and of course the Joey made it real funny. I didn't know what it was about till they were talking about it.
You know, I'm trying to stay away from it. I just can't. You know.
The Sherry, she said that she said, you know, she's for Obama, Barack, and she said that, you know, everybody says something sometime. You know, they.
Well, Juanita, do you ever go over to WD40.com? Not putting you on the spot or anything. But over at WD40.com, D-U-B-Y-A-D, the number 4 and the number 0, WD40.com.
What, WD-40 you use?
No, it's not the letter W and the letter D and then 40. It's D-U-B-Y-A-D, 40.com. D-U-B-Y-A, the W... D-U-B-Y-A-D.
Oh,
yeah, D-U-B-Y-A-D-40.com. Our buddy Clyde over there has a great little essay today that's well worth reading. And it sort of plays into this business of, you know, Jesse Jackson said, what? And it's just a brief essay, just a few paragraphs by our pal Clyde, called Manufactured Outrage.
Oh, yeah.
And he says that it... Oh, God, you know, Clyde pulls no punches, and he says, I've been active in politics ever since I was 17, and usually getting me to talk about politics is about as hard as getting Britney to show her cooch in public. But lately it seems all we ever talk about is how he said this or she said that, and hardly ever does the conversation have any real substance to it anymore.
Yeah.
He said, I really couldn't care less if Jesse Jackson said he'd like to cut Obama's off. Mm-hmm. Because he perceived Obama speaking down to the black community.
They said his son really gave him.
Yeah, but Clyde says, so what?
Yeah, right.
He said, is that so important that every news channel, radio station, newspaper, website, and carrier pigeon has to yammer on and on about it for hours on end?
The church I used to go to, that was, you know, charismatic, and it was a big church, and they rented it out of space. They rented their place out for Jesse Jackson to come and speak, and I wanted to go so bad, but it was so crowded, you know.
Yeah.
There was just standing room only, and anyway, I don't know, I think I was working or something, and I just gave up. Well, we went, I was in the preacher's wife Sunday school class. And she was talking about him, and she said, you know, I had such a low opinion of him. But she said, he's quite a person, you know. And I thought, why, you learned something about him before. He's not a perfect man, but, you know, he has done some good things, like you said before. But nobody's perfect. I don't want somebody that thinks they're perfect, because they're the ones to give you real trouble.
Well, exactly, and you know, there's the Republican right wing is a classic case in point of that.
Taken with him, you know, she said he was amazing.
And that's what happens when, you know, the, when the cult of that's why the phrase exists, cult of personality. And
yeah.
that's what all these evangelists and TV preachers have going for them. They're not delivering the gospel of Christ. They're delivering the follow me lecture of which,
yeah.
whether it's John Hagee or T.D. Jakes or Creflo Dollar or Joyce Meyer or Kenneth Copeland or Jimmy Swaggart or any of these creeps.
Guess who was on the other day together?
Who's that?
Creflo Dollar and who's the guy that threatened the Republican senator about being investigated?
Oh, Charles Grassley. Oh, no, Kenneth Copeland.
Yeah, they were on together.
Gorgeous. Well, Juanita, I'm going to run along. It's the top of the hour.
Okay, and keep up your good work.
I'm going to try. You keep being uniquely American, all right?
Okay, yeah. No, I don't want to go through that again.
you've been unique enough to last a while.
I you feel like a workhorse and you don't have anything else but work.
Take care, Juanita.
Okay, you too.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
View correspondent calling in from Central Florida, our buddy Juanita. And we'll take a little break right now. Come back and your calls or my rantings, which means it's entirely your choice. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366. That's 877, the numeral 4, head on. Go on over to WD40.com and have a look at Clyde's Corner. I loved it. And it's just plain true. If you want to dial in on your nickel, 304-658-3333, that works too. Email rolls into bob@headonradio.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Yes, we can bomb most any land on CNN with marching bands. Pour ourselves an ice cold Coke. Make a war. Tell a joke. All over me, the fear and insecurity. Yes, I am American from Pearl Harbor to Afghanistan. History, and brother, that lesson didn't come for free. The politicians, they didn't bleed. Misguided patriots, indeed. Loose, fast. Or can we find a peace that'll last? Is the answer here at home? Home. Or is it buried in a foreign storm?
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
I know I'll get questions. Hey, Bob, who the heck was that? That was some genius is what that was. That's Jason Ringgenberg from his 2004 album, Empire Builders. The name of that track is American Reprieve. I remember the first time I heard that whole album, I felt like that guy in that old Memorex tape ad just slammed back into the chair with, you know, my hair blowing backwards. Powerful. As powerful a statement from start to finish as any piece of musical composition that I've lately heard. Empire Builders by Jason Ringgenberg. You might remember Jason from Jason and the Scorchers. Another great thing. Great in their own right. Check it out. Check out the whole album. If it's not in your collection already, it is certainly worth having there. And a quick arts and entertainment reminder. This is some treats, folks. There's a guy, and he is a master craftsman of the blues genre. He's also a friend of mine. His name is Roger Hurricane Wilson. And you want to talk about a hard-working guy. I mean, all year, every year, all over the country, playing the blues, keeping the blues alive. And I know we've got a substantial listenership up east. And I also admit to a lack of certain geographic familiarity with that neck of the woods, so it may be a million miles from you just the same. But if you want to just bathe in some mind-blowing, beautiful blues, I want to clue you in to the Roger Hurricane Wilson schedule. Because if any of this was anywhere near me, I get his emails letting me know, you know, what he's up to, where he's going. Roger snuck into West Virginia and I missed it. Of course, again, it's that geographic thing. If he was in Wheeling, he might as well have been on Mars for my ability to get there. But if he was in Charleston or something like that and I missed Roger, I'm going to be very upset with myself. Roger Hurricane Wilson. Now, he's got a MySpace page. MySpace.com, Roger Hurricane. And another MySpace page, Roger Hurricane Wilson, the acoustic side. But if you're up east, Roger's going to be tomorrow, Roger's going to be at McSeagall's Bistro in Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. He'll be doing solo acoustic blues from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. Then on the 12th, he's at the North Atlantic Blues Festival in Rockland, Maine, solo acoustic. Sunday the 13th, the North Atlantic Blues Festival again, solo acoustic. He's taking Monday and Tuesday off for travel, the 14th and the 15th. Then the 16th, he is at the New City Library in New City, New York. And Thursday the 17th and Friday the 18th, check him out at the Bellevue Blues Festival in Bellevue. Well, see, he gets around. We're done gone from east. Wait a minute. It can't be. I think we got a typo here. The Bellevue Blues Festival. I don't know. Google it because it's in Bellevue. Not sure where. That would be Nebraska, Roger. It can't be. Bellevue Blues Festival. Look it up. Saturday the 19th, he's at the Timothy Lake North Preserve in East Stroudsburg, PA. And then he really is out west. July the 20th and 21st, Sunday and Monday, Tully's in Sharon, PA. Then Tuesday the 22nd and Wednesday the 23rd at the Zoo Bar in Lincoln, Nebraska. I just hope your guitars get to wherever you're going, Roger. This is Thursday the 24th and the 25th of July. He's at Bear Tree in Centennial, Wyoming. Then on Saturday, July the 26th, he's at the Yacht Club Grill in Walcott, Colorado. And then that's 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. And then at 9:30 p.m., he's at Lincoln's Roadhouse in Denver. Denver listeners, pay attention. Lincoln's Roadhouse, 9:30 p.m., Saturday the 26th of July. Denver, Colorado, Lincoln's Roadhouse, Sunday the 27th, 3 to 7 p.m. Denver, Colorado, Monday the 28th and Tuesday the 29th, Burgess House concert in Denver as well. That's solo acoustic. And that's just July. And he is all over the country. So check him out if you're anywhere near anything that I just mentioned. He mentions in October of this year, he's going to be in the lineup at the legendary Arkansas Blues and Heritage Festival. That's something that used to be known as the King Biscuit Blues Festival. He'll be playing his own set and performing on the bill with Pine Top Perkins for his 95th birthday homecoming celebration. Roger is all over the place, and I tell you what, there is no better. And I mean it, no better. In terms of just sitting down and listening to some classic blues. In fact, let me see if I can make this happen for us. Why just sit here and talk about it when I can actually play you something? You've heard this before. Roger's no more in love with the for-profit media than we are. See what I mean? A little tune called Talking Heads. I don't know about you, but guitar playing like that gives me the chills. And Roger can do that hour after hour after hour. And by the way, no, I was wrong. I thought it was just crazy that you couldn't. But yeah, even as we speak, Roger's already played at the Arkansas Blues and Heritage Festival. Play there again tomorrow. Plays at 1 p.m. By 7:30 p.m., he'll be at McSeagull's Bistro in Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. How does that happen? Helena, Arkansas to Maine? Yeah, I know. It's called aircraft, Bob, but still. And I was wrong. July 18th, Bellevue Blues Festival, Bellevue, Nebraska, baby. And then the next day in East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. I mean, Roger's got to have like the three or four, maybe one of those real highfalutin Swiss watches that gives you the time in 17 different time zones. This is the living embodiment of, you know, if it's Tuesday, it must be Peoria. I mean, I think the longest stop he's got anywhere is Denver from July the 26th to the 29th. Then he's in California. Then he's in Kennesaw, Georgia. Yeah, Roger's a great guy. Back in the day when I was at CNN, I used to go watch him play a good bit around the Atlanta area, because Roger and I worked together at CNN. Bob, you shameless name dropper. Now, there's a reason I went ahead and played Roger's Talking Heads track, because I got a couple of them for you. Couple of Talking Heads moments. Now, last night I mentioned, I guess it was on the horn section, and so therefore some of you don't get the horn section, don't download it, or don't listen to it live, so it bears re-mentioning. The right wing is having a purple polka-dotted blue screaming hissy, and it goes hand in hand with what our buddy Clyde said in his Clyde's Corner commentary at WD40.com about the things that the right wing has hissies over. Me, you know, you tune in, you listen, you know the things that give me the hissies. And I'm proud to say that it's generally not, you know, the real vein poppers are not stuff, no, it's serious business. But not for the right wing. Everything has gone to hell for the right wing, so they've just got to, and that's why you can't turn on a news channel today without being up to your snuffleupagus in Jesse Jackson said. So, who chimes in on, oh Jesus, who chimes in on Obama wanting us to learn another language? Why look! Up in the air. It's a felon. It's a traitor. It's G. Gordon Liddy. I don't know. I think he may be the progenitor of the right-wing Republican porn mustache, G. Gordon. That or the right under his lip is the only place left on his body that'll grow hair. I don't know. But, yeah, this is what G. Gordon has a hissy about. Check this out.
And that, of course, is the latest pander from Barack Obama. He says that the Europeans coming over here can speak German and French. Well, yes, if you're from Germany, I would suspect you would speak German. And you would speak French. And they do study English, because English is the universal language.
Okay. Yeah, because, right, English is the... Okay, there's a certain universality to English, but there's nothing that says that you gotta. On the other hand, however, if G. Gordon Liddy was honest with his... Oh, but wait a minute, we're talking about G. Gordon Liddy, aren't we? We're talking about a guy who actively tried to subvert the Constitution more than 30 years ago. We're talking about a guy who should have a headstone over a plot of ground right now if we actually did with traitors to this country what should be done with traitors to this country. Not just kidding. But G. Gordon Liddy fails to note that the educational systems of places like Japan and Europe teach second languages and third languages and fourth languages, not because they recognize that English is the universal language of commerce, but because they recognize that if you teach foreign languages to young children, that you do miraculous things inside their brain, that you hardwire their brain for other kinds of learning. Language and music and mathematics, they're all linked. Now, to a mathematical dullard like me, and anybody observing me trying to deal with mathematics, it may not necessarily appear to be so, but it is. It just is. And that's why forward thinking, that's why enlightened educational systems teach foreign languages. That's why if you start teaching it at 5 or 6 or 7, as Barack Obama noted, it's a heck of a lot easier to teach than it is to try to learn it at 47. Indeed, indeed, indeed. So, G. Gordon Liddy's being a... Well, but G. Gordon Liddy's G. Gordon Liddy now, isn't he?
All aircraft communications and all the rest all over the world are in English. No, they're not in Russian or Chinese or anything else.
What's this mall music he's got playing behind him? And me, the guitar fan. I don't know. It'll probably turn out to be some guitar player that I just love. But never mind.
But think about that. He wants you to be sure that you're...
Here it comes. Oh, my God. Sit down. Sit down.
Your child can speak fluent illegal alien.
The first modern European novel was written in Spanish. It's called... And you know this. Don Quixote. Wasn't written in English. Wasn't written in French. It was written in Spanish. Spanish is a noble tongue. Outside of the Italian peninsula, Spanish is closest to Latin because Spain was the province that Rome settled or conquered first. That's why, among other things, George Bush at the G8 summit is hollering to the Prime Minister of Italy, "Amigo, amigo!" Because in George Bush's world, Italian and Spanish, same language. But no. G. Gordon Liddy says that Spanish, and what Barack Obama said was, if your kid learns Spanish, your kid has a leg up in the business world. Hello! One of my best buddies in college. While some of us were taking other stuff, one of my best buddies in college was taking all the French he could get. And then he went into the military and showed a facility for languages, went to that military language school, and became a fluent Russian speaker. And he translated that into a nice living for himself. But no. G. Gordon Liddy says that speaking a foreign language is tantamount to teaching your children to speak fluent illegal alien. Let's hear it again, sports fans.
Anything else? But think about that. He wants you to be sure that your child can speak fluent illegal alien. Sadly, with every legal and cultural step we take to make our life more immediately convenient for non-English-speaking illegal aliens.
See, this kind of crap just makes me want to run around the room screaming.
This kind of garbage that just spews out of the right wing on a daily basis. What was the number? Come on, 2,570, 2,320. You know, every day, 2,570 hours of this filth and this garbage. For every hour of me or Guy James or John Fox or Mark Levine or Peter Godbold or Mike Malloy or Tom Hartman or Randy Rhodes, 2,570 hours for every hour of normalcy. What, does this freak think that God speaks English or something? Oh, oh, oh. I'd love to have the time, and I know one of our listeners studies in his spare time Japanese. And then there's our buddy Robert in Japan, in Kitakyushu, who went there and actually teaches in a Japanese university and has become multilingual. It's really, you know, Gordon, newsflash, it's not a bad thing. I mean, it's certainly better, and I saw it, it's certainly better than being an American in another country that doesn't necessarily speak English as its first language, because, you know, they probably speak fluent illegal alien. It's better than having... Donde esta la bathroom? And you get the quizzical look. Where is the bathroom? You know, if you yell it a little bit louder, then it'll be comprehensible to the dumb non-English speaker. Oh! And we wonder why we have the reputation that we have. I said, where is the bathroom? I swear, sometimes around here, it is just like the miracle worker. Water, Helen, it has a name! These are the people who are more fit to run the world than us, you know, liberals.
We merely feed the beast. And you've just heard Barack Obama insisting that we all teach our children Spanish. Well, not mine. No way.
Well, I didn't know little lizard babies could speak any language at all, G. Gordon, but that's me.
Around here, let's see. I speak some French, some German, as well as English. Franklin speaks fluent French, fluent Italian, as well as English. But none of us here, so far as I know, speak illegal alien.
I just hate him. I do. I just hate him. Lord God, the poetry that has been written in Spanish. The prose that's been written in Spanish. The beautiful job that Ernest Hemingway did, rendering the formalities of Spanish into English in, Not the Sun Also Rises. Not To Have and Have Not. Dang it, why does this happen to me? Is this a senior moment? Am I getting them a little early? Oh, Gary Cooper was in the movie version. But it's he renders it with all the thee-thous and arts because of the formal usage versus the informal usage. Robert Jordan is the main character. It's gorgeous. And even if you're not a Spanish speaker, you get a sense for the beauty, because languages reflect cultures, and the cultures are beautiful. I don't care what culture it is. It has an element of beauty to it. I guess that's why I sit down and I watch things like Tony Bourdain's No Reservations, because there's a cultural respect there. I don't know. Maybe it's Thursday. Maybe this is going to turn out to be... Maybe this is going to turn out to be one of those little musical evenings.
You think? Lord. Yeah, because, G. Gordon, we know you love your Lawrence Welk and stuff. And your polkas. No, see, I'm not, no. We know you love your minuets and your tired stuff, your worn-out music. But you know what? For my money, you can't beat, Carlos Santana. But we all know that some of his songs are sung in Illegal Alien, don't we? Or, you know, there's a... My memory is just in terrible, terrible shape this evening. It may be time for a vacation. I'm thinking of some of the stuff that has come out of Cuba. And how gorgeous that is. How absolutely magical that is. But no. No, G. Gordon doesn't like that. G. Gordon doesn't like this. Because it's got Illegal Alien in it. Hear that Illegal Alien piano? How can you sit still listening to this? G. Gordon, he doesn't like that music. No, no. No, that's sung an illegal alien, G. Gordon. Jeez, what a revolting pig he is. And this just rolls in by email from our buddy David in Tennessee. One poem by Pablo Neruda. One poem outweighs every word ever said by effing G. Gordon. Here, here. Let's just try that on for size. How I wish this was in Spanish. But it's not. It's been translated into English. And yeah, oh. Because I'm illiterate in Spanish, okay? You know, we used to run those PSAs or you'd hear them here and there. You know, I know what your problem is. You can't read. I can't read in Spanish. I can't read in Russian. I can't read the spam that I get in Russian. I can't read in German. I can't read in French. Okay, a few words here and there. I can dope out some words in Greek. But, you know, generally, if it's not written in the Roman alphabet in English, I'm illiterate. And so is G. Gordon Liddy. The only difference between us is that he's proud of it. Holy smokes. Pablo Neruda, Canto 12 from the heights of Machu Picchu. Arise to birth with me, my brother. Give me your hand out of the depths sown by your sorrows. You will not return from these stone fastnesses. You will not emerge from subterranean time. Your rasping voice will not come back, nor your pierced eyes rise from their sockets. Look at me from the depths of the earth, tiller of fields, weaver, reticent shepherd, groom of totemic Guanacos, mason high on your treacherous scaffolding, ice man of Andean tears, jeweler with crushed fingers, farmer anxious among his seedlings, potter wasted among his clays, bring to the cup of this new life your ancient buried sorrows. Show me your blood and your furrow. Say to me, here I was scourged because a gem was dull, or because the earth failed to give up in time its tithe of corn or stone. Point out to me the rock on which you stumbled, the wood they used to crucify your body. Strike the old flints to kindle ancient lamps. Light up the whips glued to your wounds throughout the centuries, and light the axes gleaming with your blood. I come to speak for your dead mouths. Throughout the earth, let dead lips congregate out of the depths. Spin this long night to me as if I rode at anchor here with you, and tell me everything. Tell chain by chain, and link by link, and step by step. Sharpen the knives you kept hidden away. Thrust them into my breast, into my hands, like a torrent of sunbursts, an Amazon of buried jaguars, and leave me cry. Hours, days, and years, blind ages, stellar centuries, and give me silence, give me water, hope. Give me the struggle, the iron, the volcanoes. Let bodies cling like magnets to my body. Come quickly to my veins and to my mouth. Speak through my speech and through my blood. Yeah, I think David from Tennessee just hit one out of the park. One poem by Pablo Neruda outweighs every word ever said by effing G. Gordon. Hear, hear, David. Hear, hear. Hear, hear. But see, I have to read that in English because, as I said, I'm illiterate in Spanish. Because it was not fashionable in Alabama. It wasn't deemed necessary in Alabama to a kid who was born in the early 60s to start teaching him a foreign language. You know, when it would have been like, when learning a foreign language would have been like drinking cool water. When children my same age in France, in Germany, in Italy, in Russia, in England, in Japan, in Australia, in India,
Come on, come on. Hey, G. Gordon Liddy, buddy, there are more English speakers in China than there are in the entire rest of the world, you jerk. But it's not worth it for us to learn Mandarin. No. And by the way, G. Gordon, while we're at it, you unreconstructed, unrepentant old prick. While we're at it, you think it might have been handy to have a few Arab speakers, maybe just a few more Arabic speakers on, say, September the 1st, 2001? Or is that speaking terrorist, since learning Spanish is speaking illegal alien, you horse's ass? No, to the phones, to the phones. Let's see what's cooking. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Bob. How are you doing?
How are you, Robert? I conjured you.
You conjured me, yes. Well, when you mentioned the word, you know, language and learning languages and stuff like that, it's a conjure. It's a conjure keyword.
Well, and it is your bailiwick, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I've kicked around with a few languages myself, mainly because of, I just found Florida and the United States a tiny, tiny little cultural linguistic, box. And so, it's my, you know, in order to escape the box, you gotta learn the languages. So, I got out in 1983 the first time for a nice little 2-week vacation out of my private school hellhole in, Gainesville, Florida. Dashed off to Germany and found it an absolute paradise. So I spent 9 months while I was doing my master's degree and working full-time learning German. So that was easy, though, because, you know, English is a German language, you know.
Of its sort. It's a polyglot language when you get right down to it.
Yeah. I mean, once you learn the root words and you learn how the root words are connected, then it becomes a little bit easy. So I was able to start, you know. And also then I went to Germany and I went to the Goethe Institute after my 1 year and finished my master's to learn German, and that was the best decision of my life. Absolute paradise. The one thing I like about Germany is that there's beautiful architecture everywhere you go. Every building is just beautiful instead of the plastic metal houses of Florida and the United States. And cities have some history, and the food, there's cuisine instead of just the slop that, you know, you're getting. I actually realized what a hot dog was when I went to Germany the first time. Not the garbage that, you know, the Americans, you know, are fed. And what a beer was, you know. People think, you know, Americans drink the beer and they think that's actually beer, but that's not beer at all. I think someone said that the beer industry never recovered after Prohibition, and they just, you know, served the easiest thing to, you know, to make, and Americans said, oh, that's beer. And
yeah, because they'd forgotten what it tasted like. Right.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
See, that's if, and I know you follow the program, that's why I'm a little bit disturbed, not disturbed, but I miss my beer, since I've had to, you know, lay off, you know, just radically change my diet in the last month and a half. And, you know, when I looked at Agnes, I said, you know, it's not like I miss Miller Lite.
Yeah.
I miss sitting down. There's a little pizza joint across the river here, and they've got these beautiful Aussie beers, and they've got an all-organic one by a company called Cooper's. And I miss sitting down to a Cooper's. Or there's a place in Charleston you can go and get some good imports. And they've got a German Rauschbier, which is made with smoked malts. And to have a Rauschbier next to some pulled pork, it's epiphany. But what you're talking about, though, even the stuff that comes to the United States isn't the same.
No. I mean, even the German beers, they change that. I was really surprised. I mean, they said that I forget the name of the beer, but that, you know, they the Germans refer to that as kind of as camel piss or something like that. So I said, okay. And then, you know, I did try a Rauch beer in Germany, and that just blew me away. I had half of it, and my head was spinning.
I've got a dear friend who travels periodically to Germany, and every now and when he goes and comes back, he was in the habit of bringing me a 12-pack of Alt.
Yeah.
And Alt is something very, very special.
But, you know, not for G. Gordon Liddy, because, you know, if it ain't American, it ain't worth a...
These people fear people, I mean, Americans becoming international, because then they become more broad-minded. I mean, that's, you know, they just want Americans to be very simple, very simple-minded, only know the American, you know, white Caucasian culture, which is a very tiny, tiny thing. And because it's easy, they're easy to control that way. So, but, I ended up in Israel and I've learned all about Israeli culture and not that I'm Jewish, but you know, I ran out of money basically. So I was probably one of the few people in Israel that was there for economic reasons. So, you know, living on a kibbutz. And then I ended up on the Texas-Mexican border.
No kidding. You really lived on a kibbutz?
Yeah. Great experience.
Wow.
Well, I didn't have much choice. I mean, the 1980s, the entire world was, you know, they're all refugees. I mean, Thatcher was in office, so there were a lot of British people on the kibbutz, a lot of Danes because, you know, they were just bored, and a few Americans like myself. So, and it was quite interesting to be on a kibbutz where everybody was equal. It was all socialized, and the managers, there were no elites. The managers had to do their turn doing washing the dishes. And it was 6 hours of work for 6 days. And, you had, you know, health care, and after 6 hours of work, you could do whatever you wanted. And you had trips every month. So if people want to just have a little break, a kibbutz is a good idea. Because, you know, the kibbutz would take in a nice little trip and show you the country. And so it was a good, almost a year. I mean, I got there in 1983, saw Christmas in Bethlehem, and, Jerusalem, I went there 7 times. So, yeah, I know all about the Jews, and it's funny because the Jews do look upon the Christians as strange alien beings, you know.
Yeah, it's the one place on the earth where they can do that and not get killed for it, so.
Yeah, right, exactly, right, so.
Because you know what, we are strange alien beings in so far
yeah,
as.
Well, I mean, it was strange to have the shoe on the other foot, you know, where.
Yeah.
I was being looked down on as a cult strange freak member instead of, and then, you know, learning about discrimination on the other side of the foot, so. But even the Jews, you know, from other countries, they're looked upon as second class citizens, you know, because, you know, they're not Israelis, they're not, you know.
Well, sooner or later, Orwell's pig farm fact, not pig farm, but,
Animal farm
factor
right.
Kicks in, you know, where all pigs are equal, but some pigs are more equal than other pigs.
Exactly, right, right. But
I think it's a basic human impulse, isn't it, Robert?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everywhere you go, I remember on the kibbutz farm, there's, you know, kibbutz magazines, and one said, "If we're all equal," it was written by a woman, "how come I'm doing the work and still doing the dishes and the cooking?" So. But you know, I worked with South American Jewish women in the kitchen for a month or so, and then I ended up picking oranges and grapefruits, and then I worked in the kibbutz factories cutting envelopes at 4 o'clock in the morning. Because my kibbutz was the only second factory that made envelopes. So I got into the country. I did not. I asked the guy. I said, "What language do they speak there?" And he said he was shocked. He said, "Well, it's big Hebrew." I said, "Oh, well, not only a few people did that, but." But it was a fun experience. I got there in the Lebanon War, so inflation was out of control. So prices would go up every week, 20-30%. But since I was on the kibbutz, I was kind of insulated by all this. But the Texas-Mexico border experience was an eye-opener. You know, I was teaching junior high school, and I was teaching Spanish. I had 4 years of Spanish, basically. I couldn't speak it very well, but I knew the grammar inside and out, and so that's what they wanted, because the Mexican-Americans knew how to speak it, but they didn't know the grammar. But it was an insight into Mexican-American culture, and there's a whole complex of psychology there that they were trying to prove themselves to be Americans and not Mexicans. And so I lived with a Mexican-American family because it was a volunteer position, made about $150 a month. And, and that family, that the man said, he really hated his Mexican heritage. And he gave me several reasons, because of the corruption and everything else. But the Mexican Americans were most afraid of their Mexicans, because the Mexicans were the ones that are going to take their jobs away, not the white people. So if you, and I taught in the poorest county in the United States, which was Hidalgo, which is, I think, Mission, Texas, was the closest city. So I went across to Reynosa about 7-8 times and went down to Monterey one time, and it was an eye-opener.
See, I'm particular. I mean, I'm. And by the way, the novel that I couldn't think of was, of course, For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Okay.
The Hemingway novel, where he renders Spanish so beautifully into English.
Right.
But I'm enamored of what happened to Spanish when it ran up against those gorgeous languages of Meso and South America. Because
he said he could not read Spanish. No, the Spanish that was used actually by the Spanish. So it's been really changed a lot, especially in the border region. And there's a real psychology being of northern Mexico versus the central Mexicans and the southern Mexicans.
And look what's going on even as we speak in Oaxaca.
Yeah.
And that has 500-year-old roots, Robert. You know, the land grabs versus the communal holding of property versus the privatization and all of, you know, that goes all the way back to the early Spanish estancias, and it ain't over. But when you take a language like Nahuatl, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, which is still spoken by a million people, indigenous peoples in Mexico, and you butt it up against or any of the other languages that obtained, and you butt it up against Spanish, you're gonna get some incredible things, to this look. The Mississippi, the Ocmulgee, the Chattahoochee, the Tennessee, the Ohio, the Allegheny, and I mean, here in my home, we still have a recipe that we make periodically for something called corn pone, and lo and behold, pone. Pone is an eastern seaboard, I think maybe Delaware Indian word for what it is we make, and lo and behold, maybe it's because of some last vestige of the blood that flows through my blonde-haired, blue-eyed veins that we've hung on to that word.
There's so many attempts to purify the language. I remember even in Israel that there was a committee trying to purify the Hebrew words because there's so many new words technologically that had never been introduced into Hebrew, like, you know, airplane, telephone, fax machine.
Yeah, seeing how Ezekiel didn't have any of those.
No. So they were, you know, and then the French, of course, they go bonkers on this as well. But
you know what they call a Big Mac over there? It's a Royale with avec fromage.
Sure.
That scene from Pulp Fiction. I love that.
Well, even in Japan, this is a big problem where a lot of foreign words are, you know, there's just no name for it in Japanese. There's no kanji for it, and so
Bezaburu.
They use the second alphabet. We have three alphabets, so they use the second alphabet to do it. It causes a lot of angst, supposedly.
Well, I remember the wonderful person I worked with at CNN who had done. And we've talked about her before, but she had done, I think she was a weather girl or something over there, but she was American born. And she said, you know, a lot of American words just get an ooh hung on the end of it, and there it is. Bezabaru, Izukremu, Makadanododo. But that's the very essence of human communication and human speech.
Well, I mean, in Japan, it's a situation where English is used a lot. I mean, English is kind of like like Spanish in a sense. I mean, in terms of how it's viewed by Americans, you know, the Japanese really don't really know how to speak English. I mean, if you were to go into a taxi cab, try to get a taxi cab and speak English, you're out of luck. Go into a restaurant, try to speak English, you're out of luck. It's got to be Japanese. But they use English all over the place and billboards and stuff because they love the Roman lettering and they love the idea of just having English, and it's real fancy and it's a real positive thing. And in some ways I think, my God, if we had the same amount of Japanese in English as the Japanese have and with English, the right wing would just go crazy. You know, oh my God, we're a cultural colony. You know, but they're so relaxed about it, so I'm so amazed.
And like you said, you know, German was easy. French, things like that, you know, I maintain that if you pick up Latin, Spanish, French, Italian, that it's all going to just be a cakewalk.
Yeah.
How difficult was it for you to inject, because you've got to get the mindset, it's a matter of thinking that way too. How difficult was it for you to cross that barrier with Japanese?
Oh, it's still being crossed, yeah. I mean, I'm still, you know, still studying. I mean, think about it. I mean, even the Japanese study about 18 years to master the language, and even by junior high school, they still can't read the newspaper because there's still too many kanji that they haven't learned yet. So you have to learn about 5,000 kanji, 4,000 kanji.
And the kanji, they're pictographs?
Pictographs, right.
Or stylized pictographs?
Yeah, right, exactly. And then you still have two other alphabets to learn. So you have to learn the hiragana and the katakana. And so the katakana is used for foreign words and names. And so my name is actually spelled in katakana. And it's actually pronounced, because there's no L in Japanese.
Right.
And so it's actually R. So it comes off as Mr. Wrong instead of Long.
Yes.
So my first lesson, my very first...
Your wife married Mr. Wrong.
Mr. Wrong, right. And so I tell my sister, don't call me Mr. Wrong, okay? It's Long. So it's a real mind bender. But if you have, you know, 10 hours a day to devote to it, then you can learn it in maybe 3 years or 4 years. But very few foreigners, even the ones married to Japanese, have actually, they sometimes just give up. They go to maybe 1,000 kanji and they just give up for. I still continue, you know, but I know enough to get through the day. I read my emails and stuff like that, but I actually found Chinese a lot easier. So I studied Chinese because I dated a lot of Chinese women in college. That was my hobby.
And a fine one it is.
Indeed it was, yeah. Very passionate women. That's why there's a billion of them. But the Chinese was easier because of the grammar, because Japanese grammar is very convoluted. And there's a lot of particles that you have to know, and that's why they call the Japanese the devil's tongue, the missionaries. But the Chinese was much easier because it was just noun, verb, object, and you just learned there's no second alphabet, third alphabet.
And verb tenses are very bizarre or non-existent or something in Chinese, if I understand.
Yeah, right. So it's very easy. Yeah, but where we have all kinds of tenses, and then you have to learn the second language of politeness, which is keigo, which I'm still learning. Not that I use it. People use it for me, but I rarely have to use it.
Well, one of our emailers, our buddy Tosh, wrote in today. He said, I wonder if Robert in Japan needs a colleague, because he's pretty well disgusted with the way things are going here. I wonder if Robert in Japan needs a colleague. I could teach math and English and work on my Japanese. And then he writes in English and he says, Nihongo don kokoshimus.
Well, there's all kinds of opportunities here, that's for sure. But it's got to get in now because as the economy worsens, there's always going to be, you know, floods of people coming and looking for other work, no matter where it is. And so, I mean, that's why I'm here. I mean, I left in the early 1990s after having seen the light about where I was in the 1980s, and there was actually no future in America. So I was ready to get on that plane, boy. I was almost pushing people aside. And then we stopped over in Seattle. And a policeman asked me, as I was boarding in the plane to go into, I think, Tokyo, he said, are you taking any money out? And I just laughed at him. I said, I'm an American. I have no money. And he said, and then I guess he was satisfied with that answer. He let me go. You're free to go.
Your lack of paper is in order.
I was kind of disgusted, though, because, you know, if I was a millionaire or a billionaire and I could, you know, shuffle money around in the blink of an eye, that's okay. But if I'm taking a few, you know, thousand out, you know, oh, no, stretch them. So,
Well, I got to ask you just a quick shift on the fly, Robert. Much buzz over there over the G8?
Oh, yeah, we were just talking. I mean, I sent you that email yesterday. We were discussing about the 24-hour meals. Dishes. per person.
Yes.
Yesterday. And we're all kind of disgusted about that. And even when I was talking to the Japanese, no one expected anything. It's like a show. It's a damn show. You know? And I think we've got to get to the sense that, you know, we can never expect anything to come out of these elites. They're not going to do anything. I mean, look at it. They had the show and they couldn't even come to a conclusion.
No.
They had 24 courses and they couldn't even come to a conclusion. I mean, come on. You could give me 4 courses and I could come to a conclusion or something, you know. But you know, the UN minister, I saw in CNN, Moon, the UN.
Yeah, Ban Ki-moon.
Right. He said, nothing's going to happen until Bush leaves. In so many words, that's what he said. And he said, so true.
And then what he did when he left, you know, goodbye from the world's biggest polluter.
yeah, right. Yeah. One of my part-timers was saying, you know, actually the temperatures, one of the probable scenarios is that in 10 years, the temperatures will go up 6 degrees. And he said, think about it. How that's going to change everything. I mean, we've already got droughts in West Timor. People are starving to death. African-sized starvation, malnutrition in Timor. If it goes up 6 degrees, well, you know, Indonesia, Timor, Philippines, they all become deserts. So where is 80 million people in the Philippines, for example, supposed to go?
Oh, they're supposed to die because they're not nice and white, like, you know.
Exactly. Or even in Kyushu, I mean, he said even with 44 degrees Celsius, which is what, over 100 degrees, is that really going to be feasible for Kyushu in Japan? And, maybe you run the air conditioners a lot, but then the water supplies probably all be evaporating like they are now in Spain, you know? So then I watched that fantastic show on Greenland and CNN the other day. They're saying how great Greenland is now.
Yeah, because it's downright balmy, I guess.
Yeah, they're having ranches and cows, and they're raising vegetables now, broccoli and all.
And they don't have the common sense to recognize. You've heard me mention, Robert, that brilliant book by Jared Diamond called Collapse. He did Greenland. He's already explained that you can't do that in Greenland because the soil is about nowhere thick. Same thing applies to Iceland. Oh, Iceland's a wonderful. But there's, you know, it's like soil, rock.
Rock, right.
And the erosion that follows from all of that, it's great for a couple of decades, and then you look up and go, hey, nothing's growing anymore.
Well, there's also no snow, so that was one of the problems they talked about, was that, you know, the reindeer was having some problems because there's no water, or there was, I don't know, I couldn't quite follow it, but there was no snow left, and so, it's not a rosy picture even there. So, and the biggest problem though is all that water that's going to go into the Gulf Stream may slow the Gulf Stream down, and so the Gulf Stream stops, and then you have an ice age. So, as it happened before. So, but so the G8, they had some nice food and they talked and they didn't come to a conclusion because they're too stupid. I mean, there's no other word for it.
But let's
targets for 2050.
Yeah, I know. 2000.
Yeah.
Please.
Come on.
Yeah, we need solutions for 2009.
10. Yeah, 9. Yeah.
The December 08 would be good.
Yeah.
I saw somebody in the chat room say a little bit ago that, you know, there's another big chunk of ice popping off of Antarctica, and somebody said, you know, I hope they got cameras on it so that they can take footage and then just, you know, shove it sideways down the throat of the deniers.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, they said Greenland. They said, you know, the whole topography has changed. I mean, it's nothing but lakes and rivers and all kinds of stuff. So it's like, oh, great. So.
But it's no solution. I mean, we've seen, history has seen these migratory patterns. It leads to massive bloodshed. It leads to carnage. It leads to societal and cultural and technological collapse.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. I mean, if it gets hotter and hotter, then there's equatorial countries like Indonesia, Philippines, India. They're all becoming deserts. Yeah, where are they going to move? Hundreds of millions of people. Can't imagine.
And, well, you know, many will die in place. You know, and I don't in objecting to that menu, it was kind of tough for me because, well, Robert, I mean, I'm a foodie, okay, and a lot of that stuff I'd love to try. You know, the beetroot foam, the stuff that's inspired by Ferran Adrià over in Spain. I mean, that's where all that comes from, all that foam and all the decoctions and deconstructions of food. It's brilliant. It's brilliant stuff with it, but it's also something that is not accessible to most people.
Well, I mean, you remember my conversation with you last year, I think, when I had my Filipino in-law coming, and she didn't even know what broccoli was. She had never seen broccoli before. So.
Yeah.
And all that stuff, you know.
Most of the... I'm reminded, I forget who said it, but somebody on this program said, yeah, remember, most of the world not only hasn't seen the Internet, most of the world hasn't heard a telephone ring.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2008, and most of the world still hasn't heard a telephone ring.
Right.
I've got a story in the stack here that says that, and I find this very interesting because this is with regard to the United States, that according to a study, broadband internet access is up overall in the U.S., but it's down among the poor.
Mm, well, that makes sense, yeah.
Especially strong increases in broadband adoption this year. It's up rurally 23% since 2007. Lower to middle income Americans, household incomes between 20 grand and 40 grand, up 24%. Older Americans, age 50 and up, it's up 25%. Among African Americans, however, broadband access only rose from 40 to 43%, and in households with incomes below 20 grand, access dropped from 28 to 25%. That's the United States. You know, and to the same extent that a big part of the world has never heard a phone ring, Robert, there's a big part of this world that has never dined on anything but rice or millet.
Mm-hmm.
Whose dietary augmentation is of only minimal protein. You know, we started talking about the interaction between the Spanish and the indigenous Mexican peoples. There were no sheep. There were no domesticated pigs. There were no cattle. There were no horses on this entire continent prior to 1492, or in this entire half of the world. And you talk about the genius of a culture, the Mexica culture that built Tenochtitlan, which was at that time, if not the largest, one of the largest cities on earth, was providing protein for its people via beans.
Right.
And via fish and fowl and dog and some wild game. Paris, Rome, Constantinople, London, none of those could have done that with those kind of resources. And then, you know, you talk about how the missionaries called Japanese the devil's tongue. Go back and research the remarks of the missionaries who landed in what was then New Spain. They swore that Nahuatl was inspired by Satan, because it was so absolutely incomprehensible to their Spanish-speaking tongue. Maybe this is turnabout as fair play, because they were as bigoted about Nahuatl as Gordon Liddy is turning around and being bigoted about Spanish.
Right, exactly.
You know, whether it's, everybody loves, well, not everybody, there's a lot of people that hate it. I love guacamole. I love avocados. Well, avocado is a direct pass from Nahuatl, only it was ahuacatl. Guacamole, the word M-O-L-E, is the Nahuatl word for mixture, and ahuacamole, the mixture made of the ahuacatl fruit, becomes guacamole. Mexico becomes Mexico because the Spanish could not pronounce the sh sound any more than the Japanese can pronounce the L sound.
R. All right,
or R sound. R sound.
Yeah, L sound, yeah.
So what was Mexica becomes Mexico. Iztaccíhuatl, the volcano, and becomes Ix or it or silentized or H'd or whatever. It's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. And to have some former treason committing punk SOB like Gordon Liddy holding forth on why no one speaks, none of the people he knows speaks illegal alien. You know, I mean, in terms of universal justice, it wouldn't bother me a bit to find out that, you know, somebody had taken him out in a back alley and literally choked him to death on a Spanish grammar book. But I'm just a jerk that way, Robert. So, you know,
it's one of these dreams that, you know, we should have, I suppose. These people are just filth, you know, and for Limbaugh to get $400 million, that's still a chicken bone in my throat. I mean, God.
Yeah, it's a real hairball.
It is. No way.
Well, Robert,
I just thought I'm glad you conjured me up there.
I'm so glad. I hadn't heard from you in a while. I'm glad things are going well. And, you know, chime in anytime and give our best to everybody there at the university, please.
Okay.
All right. Take care, Robert. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Our Key to Kyushu University correspondent, Robert, calling. It's Robert's morning. It's probably time to get off to work. Let's see. Let's take a little break. Since we're on this language kick, John Fox sent something along that I think will work just perfectly. And you'll understand why in just a second. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. And we'll be right back. J'aurai toujours faim de toi. À la les gendarmes. How about that?
tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
Past the hour. Where do you want to take the rest of the program? It is entirely up to you. But so is every show. Let's find out. Let us go straight away to the phones. Hey, welcome
to
the program.
Good evening.
Hey, David, what's up?
Well, I was listening to, I hope you're not getting too depressed over the country, Bob.
Yeah, you know, all you can do is try to just sort of look away or focus on something else every now and then. I mean, I don't have the warm bath running and the single-sided razor blades out or anything, if that's what you mean. No.
Well, I've thought about it for some time, and I've come up with, a potential theory on why it is we experience, why we're experiencing this downturn in America. If we believe that the Earth is a universal organism, and we're just parasites on it, our consciousness and our minds and everything, when we need to inspire great art and great literature and just great sources of information, usually that's an amount of suffering that comes with that. In the same respect that what happened in Europe and what happened in other countries throughout the ages is what's going to happen to America, where we'll go through a renaissance. But we're probably not likely to witness that. And I guess I look at it as the pendulum swings back at us, and we just have to experience the suffering that comes with it and the downturn of society, and then the great artists will arise out of that. That's how I'm beginning to see it right now.
Are you familiar, David, with the arts projects that arose out of the Great Depression?
Vaguely.
Among other people, unless I am profoundly mistaken, Orson Welles got his start. And then the National Recovery Theater or something like that. That is how broad based and how broad minded the federal government was in its approach to getting out of the Depression, because we didn't just want to put the shoemakers back to work or the carpenters or the glaziers or the plasterers back to work. We damn sure wanted to put the actors and the singers and the scene painters back to work too. And so there was federal recovery money for theater, and people like Orson Welles, John Houseman.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to have the opportunity once upon a time to sit and talk to John Houseman at length about all of this back when I was a student, and he talked about all that, and he said, you know, it was a brilliant time. He said there was terrible, terrible hardship. Nobody had nothing. But there was a profound outgrowth of the arts. The same thing happens in post-revolutionary Russia, mm-hmm. with the rise of the Moscow Art Theater there. And so I think there's an element of truth in what you say, in that, you know, people say, well, you know, the artist has to suffer for his art. In many ways, culture has to suffer for art.
Yeah.
Look at Picasso's Guernica painting. You know, that's all based on the Nazi bombing of Guernica in Spain. And it's one of the most moving, enigmatic, for what it is, it's like listening for little hidden meanings in a Pink Floyd album, only it's art on a wall.
Mm.
And it is born out of cultural suffering. Michelangelo had to literally struggle to do his stuff. Michelangelo went off and dissected cadavers to understand the human form, because the church was so repressive it wouldn't allow actual human representation. And he had to do it on the sly and turn around and use it to create so-called sacred art,
but at the same time dealing with very secular topics. And that goes on through most of the Italian art renaissance. And it's all born out of repression, and it's all born out of suffering. You know, what did John Barrymore say? It's one of my favorite lines out of the theater. They asked John Barrymore if it was difficult to play a death scene. And he said, "My boy, dying is easy. Comedy is hard."
Yeah, I remember that. I think it has to do with the more conveniences you add, you can think of it, the more you're trying to run away from suffering, but at the same time, it's like you're running downhill and there's a boulder coming right after you.
Where did the single greatest American musical art forms come from? Jazz and blues.
Obviously suffering and poverty.
Yeah.
And that goes, the only thing I can see is like a hindrance when it comes to the arts, because I consider science and art, that might be a little harder to get through, but I mean, it's what birthed hip hop, and look where hip hop is now. But then also look at the same thing. We gave everything to the hip hop generation, and you turn on a TV and you see the culture dissipating right in front of your eyes. And everything has pretty much become homogenized when it comes to the bigger picture of the music and the culture, and that's intentional, because I believe when you do focus on so much of giving someone everything that they've asked for as a person in a well-populized and successful nation, or just having enough to get by, or what have you, when you have everything in front of you, you start to become numb to it. You don't realize what you have. And then in turn, I guess that makes you lazy in a way for a lot of people, because there isn't that.
Look at the great art we're producing now in this country, David. Yeah. Look at reality television. Now, this is in no way denigrates the art, the real stuff that's being produced out there, musical, visual, graphic, linguistic, what have you. But the poetry? I dare you. Get outside of a college campus town and just ask somebody in the grocery store, "What's the last poem you read?" They're liable to call the authorities to take you away.
I remember turning on right-wing radio, and they had a fit. It was just for an hour, though. I just tuned in at the right time, I guess. Or the worst time. It depends on your perspective. They were going on and on about Amir Baraka, and he was the poet for New Jersey, and they couldn't believe it. And they were like, "Oh, my God, I can't believe they're actually – this guy gets a salary for being a poet." And I was like, "This is ridiculous. This guy worked hard and he earned his rights and status."
Oh God! If you've ever read In a Supermarket in California, wow! Because the poet's art is the ability to make a whole movie inside your head, and it's the lyricist's art too, and it's the musician's art to create entire, and then the novel. Anybody who does anything that isn't coming in through your eyeballs in the first place is to make this whole thing happen between your ears that wouldn't otherwise exist. And then the painter or the sculptor, those people put stuff in through your eyes that make you hear things and feel things.
It's the battle of commerce and art. We've gone from extreme poetry to, I don't know if you're probably not familiar with it, because you live in an isolated place, and I don't think they have cars driving by you every day. But there's a song called "Millie" by Lil Wayne, and he's a rapper, and he sold a million copies of his album in a week, and all a Millie is this repeat loop of a guy saying "a Millie, a Millie, a Millie, a Millie," and the whole song is just about I'm successful and I'm a millionaire and here's how I make my money. And that's pretty much I hate to say it, but
is that the manifestation of what we saw in Idiocracy, when the number one movie in the land is a movie called Ass?
You know what's funny about it is the fact that Lil Wayne, I I give props to him for building his business. He's done something unprecedented, which he was a child rapper, and he became an adult rapper, which is you know, that is so rare. It's like the child actor syndrome, where the only one child rapper I can think of who's done that is LL Cool J. But Lil Wayne to me, they really do cheer on this kind of stupidity and these kind of antics. And you can tell this guy is literally, drug addled to an extent. I guess he drinks a lot of the thing in the South is cough syrup. This is like an epidemic. I don't know if you know about that, but.
Oh, cough syrup's been an epidemic for eons. Yeah.
Yeah, but then they mixed it with the.
Red Bull? Tell me they're mixing cough syrup with Red Bull, David. I'll run screaming around the room.
I think they do that. You see,
kidding me.
They do it with all kinds of things. They do it with Hypnotic. Here's the interesting thing about it. The reason why they do it is this is what's inspired the music movement Screwed. It's almost like the same way the jazz affected heroin. People become so addled that they can't like talk or give interviews and they're completely incoherent. But at the same time, you have people cheering them on just like in Idiocracy. Yeah!
I know. And some of this is door opening stuff. Hey, I gotta ask you though. I mean, I know you dig so many musical forms.
Yeah.
What I was talking about earlier, how far are you from Booth Bay Harbor, Maine?
You know what? I'm thinking of going.
How far are you from Rockland?
Oh, about 2 or 3 hours.
If you can make any of those gigs, you will call and thank me. Rogers' gigs at the North Atlantic Blues Festival are all solo acoustic.
I can probably talk my dad into going to it. Sometimes he goes on the weekend with his Volvo campers places. So.
Well, McSeagull's Bistro in Booth Bay Harbor. And then the North Atlantic Blues Festival in Rockland, Maine, from tomorrow through Sunday.
What day is Roger playing? The 12th?
Roger's playing the North Atlantic Blues Festival on the 12th and the 13th.
On the 12th and the 13th.
I'm not sure what time.
Yeah, I probably would only go one day, so
yeah.
I'd have to decide between Saturday.
It would be a mind-bending experience. I wish I was up there. Because I could sit and watch Roger Hurricane Wilson play all day and all night.
Well, I'll tell you what. If I go, I'll give you a report back Monday. I just want to say this. I really do appreciate what Dennis Kucinich is, and I think maybe he did push Nancy Pelosi to consider hearings. And the truth is, we're probably not going to get what we want at all, but we are going to... We'll at least get some kind of hearings and get to hear the voices of the people. So when they look back in history, they say, see, some people were expressing.
You got to make a record.
You have to make a record, no matter how much pain and suffering you're going to have. You have to look at everything through a lens and realize, you know, what was it they had on this episode of where I haven't watched it yet on the Ted Koppel in China yet, the China documentary.
Mm-hmm.
There was a part in it, one of the executive producers said about it. She said, I went into the squalor of a village, and she said, how can you live like this? And the woman looked up to me in her squalor, and she says, this is the best it's ever been. Please don't take this away from me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes you got to look at it that way. I mean,
what Dennis Kucinich is doing is concerned, David.
Yeah.
And whether there might be hearings or not, George Bush made a statement the other day. He said that telecom immunity was more important than some other thing that he wanted. There's a reason. Because if those lawsuits go forward and those companies don't have that immunity, and this is the part that's really annoying. In that, you know, you and I can understand this, and yet our six-figure salaried multimillionaire elected representatives can't. is that the reason the telecom immunity had to happen, and there was a little signing statement today, and there was a little signing, and there was Joe Lieberman holding hands with Dick Cheney, and it was all just so cute, is that the reason the telecom immunity had to happen is if any one of these suits actually was able to get via discovery a look at the Bush administration logs of who they were listening into, you're going to find out that they were listening to John Kerry. You're going to find out that they were listening to John Edwards. You're going to find out that they were listening to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and it's going to, and it would make Watergate look like a walk in the park.
You know, Bob, just one last thing regarding this. I really think it would be interesting, and I think you should put it on your list of things to plan for interviews, to have an interview with the ACLU law team who are going to sue the government. I don't know if you covered that story yet.
Well, I've mentioned it, at least I think, or maybe I just mentioned it in an email to someone. But, yeah, the ACLU is going to sue. What bothers me out of that, though, David, is that I know what's going to happen when the ACLU sues. And now they're not going to sue over, I mean, they're going to sue over the law itself, so it's not going to touch the underlying cases. But what's going to happen when the ACLU sues is the Bush administration is going to send this humorless little lawyer from the Justice Department wearing a very dark, plain suit and a white shirt and a skinny tie and out-of-fashion lapels on his coat with his little briefcase into the court, and he's going to whisper in the district judge's ear, and he's going to say, "National security!" And it's all going to be over.
Well, I think it would be great to hear from the legal team on their perspective and that what they think their chances are and what they think we can get out of this kind of...
I think Mark Levine's got that contact, but I think if he doesn't, I will. Yeah, that's a good suggestion, Dave.
All right, Bob. And just one last thing. I'm going to try to send you some music for Trapeze because I think someone should hear what I was talking about John Fox about, the guitarist who passed away.
Absolutely. I look forward to hearing it.
All right, Bob.
All right, take care, David. Hey, I hope you can make the show.
I will try to, and I'll look out for you in your mail for that.
Oh, yeah, and if your dad's a rock and roller and a blues guy, he will cuss himself for not hearing this guy play.
I'll pass it on to him.
All right, take care, David.
All right, later.
Bye now. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. And let's move on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Vince.
Yeah, what's up?
Oh, I don't know. How about you?
Just sitting in back. I've got a long commute now. I don't know if I mentioned it in the chat room the last time I was in, but I got that job.
Yeah, you did mention that you got the job, but it came with a commute?
Yeah, it came with a commute. Well, until I get myself moved down there, which is happening sooner than I expected. I'm driving about, it's about an hour there and an hour back.
Ouch. Hope you've got something relatively economical in terms of gas mileage.
I've got a Chevy Malibu, and believe it or not, those things, when you drive them properly in the early morning and late afternoon, if I run with the AC off, I can get almost 40, so it's not too bad.
No, it's not bad at all, especially for an American car.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Too bad the company that's making it is talking about going into bankruptcy. I mean, geez, the news coming out. The comment I was going to make is I listen to the news anymore, and geez, telecom immunity and GM going into bankruptcy and Arantest and missiles. Oh my, you know.
Right, and but don't worry because Phil Graham says that it's all a mental recession, Vince.
Mental recession.
Yeah, okay, Phil Graham, economic advisor to John the McCain-Churian candidate, says it's a mental recession and we're all a bunch of whiners.
What is the definition of that?
Well, he says, you know how you can have mental depression? Well, this is a mental recession, and it's because people are just sitting around whining.
Okay, so everybody's just sitting around and thinking, God, life sucks, and it makes it so. I mean, granted, there is a certain logic to that argument, but no, that ain't what's happening. You didn't just have a bunch of people sit down one day and go, you know what? I think the economy sucks. You think the economy sucks? Oh, yeah, the economy. You think the economy sucks? Oh, yeah. Next thing you know, everybody thinks the economy. It don't work that way. At least I don't think it works that way.
But see, if you're a Repiglick and Vince, any problem with the American economy is just because
Americans aren't working hard enough. We're a bunch of lazy victims.
Yeah, like, I don't remember if I got to have this conversation with you, and if I did, stop me. It's like the last time I was talking to my old boss, well, he wasn't really crazy. His brother was a crazy Christian one. But it's like we were having this discussion about how we were sitting here talking about healthcare and whatnot because of a letter that I had written into the editor. Somebody had posted a letter to the editor about how, you know, healthcare needed fixed in this country. Another guy responded to him calling him basically a socialism promoter, and I responded to him telling him he was full of it, basically. And my boss read the letter, and we got into a discussion. He says, well, you know, and, you know, he read the letter, and one of the points I made in the letter is that, you know, people, you know, the old, you know, the axiom about quality food and, or no, quality food, quality fast and cheap, pick any two.
Yeah.
Well, the axiom we're living with now in this country is food, gas, or healthcare. Pick any two.
Pick it. No, no. See, I think we're at pick any one, Vince.
Well, and I was just about to say, and some people pick any one. Some people don't get to pick any. And, you know, my bosses, and after we'd gone back and forth about this for a little while, my boss finally said, well, you know what, Vince? I have an answer for that, and you're not going to like it. And I said, no, go ahead and shoot it at me. He goes, maybe some people need to go out and get a second job. And I said, well, I mean, I understand where he's coming from. And I said, well, I understand that. And don't get me wrong. I said, my father, when he got laid off from General Motors, before he got the job that landed him in the airline industry, my dad got up in the morning. He went to his first job. He went to his second job. He went to his third job. Then he went and, or no, he didn't go to his third job. He went to college. Then he went and donated blood, or not donated, sold blood under, like, four different names. And then he came home, slept for 3 hours, got up, and did it again. So don't tell me about getting a second job. I know all about that. And I've done it myself a couple times. Not quite to that extreme, but that's what my dad had to do to support his family for a little while. And I said, but let me ask you something. When you start complaining about the moral decline in this country and about people not having, you know, kids not having parental figures. I said, why do you think that is? It's because you've got mom and dad out there working two jobs apiece just to make ends meet.
But see, they've got an answer for everything, Vince, because the comeback to that is, well, that's not because they have to do it to make ends meet. That's because they want the new TV and the fancy new car.
That was exactly what he threw back.
See? I've been around these people too long, Vince, I'm telling you.
We sat here and bickered back and forth about it, but I mean, you know, the point was made. It's a very sad situation. I mean, I was surprised this guy, I didn't think they were going to cave on this. I was surprised that, you know, they actually got the telecom thing passed, because I mean, and I don't know why the heck I think this, because every time I say to myself, oh, the Democrats aren't going to cave on that.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah, they will. Yeah, turn around, there they did. And I hate to say this, you know, now for the purposes of self-disclosure, I work for a telecom company. So
can't be helped. I mean, gotta eat.
Well, yeah, I understand that. So, I mean, this does somewhat directly affect me. And, you know, we were reading over some of the terms and conditions and stuff that we offered. You know, they flat out say if you read the terms and conditions, if you're with one of the big, you know, companies, they'll flat out say your terms and conditions. We collect information about your usage patterns, billing information, you know, all the information they collect on you, and they say that they will disclose that information to the U.S. federal government upon
request. No court order, no subpoena, just, you know, mother may I. Yeah.
And I mean, I when we were going through this part, and because right now I'm in training, and while we were going over this part in training, I was just sitting there biting my tongue because I wanted to say something, and it had nothing to do with the class at topic. It was a purely political rant, and I was just sitting there, Vince, this ain't the time or the place. Just keep your mouth shut.
Yeah. Shut up and pass the class.
Yeah, basically. But, I mean, it's still, I mean, that's just insane. I can't understand. That law has, somebody's got to challenge that on some sort of constitutional grounds. I mean, I'm trying to think of what
Hey, guess what? You go to the doctor. You go to a new doctor. You get to fill out the Privacy Act notice. Did you ever read the Privacy Act notice, Vince? The Privacy Act notice that you sign at the doctor's office says you ain't got no privacy. And it says that they, and it says the same thing that you just went through. It says, and upon request, we will furnish anything to the government that they tell us that they want.
And on the name of patriotism, and that just...
Yep, everybody stand up and sing!
It's just, oh my God, I can't believe it. And I was driving to work and I heard, well, the new warrantless wiretapping thing, I'm like, it passed? I know, I drove off the road, I'm not kidding you. I'm like, what the, I screamed in the car, what the bleep? You know?
Yeah, it did, like, but it did, and it took, it took 21 quisling Democrats to make it pass. Democrats named Rockefeller and Obama. And Nelson,
yeah,
and Nelson, and Landrieu, and Pryor, and Lincoln.
Don't get me started on the fact that Obama voted for it. Don't get me started.
Well, you know, bless his heart, Mark Levine explained why that happened. And
I must have missed it. Well,
if you listen to it through the filter of, you know, this is Washington. It makes perfect sense. It's politics, pure and simple. And anybody who thinks that Hillary Clinton, who voted against it, by the way, good for her, who thinks she would have voted against it were she the nominee? No. Another think coming.
What does being the nominee have to do anything? I think public opinion is largely against this. I think this is mostly a political thing, isn't it? Because everybody I've talked to...
Right, but you see... Obama, somebody, you know, said, you know, listen, you vote against, vote for the amendment to strip the immunity. That way you can say that you did the right thing. But then when they asked you why you voted for it overall, even with the immunity still in it, you say, listen, we had to have something to protect us against the terrorists because the Democrats, Vince, are absolutely shaken all the way down to their blessed little toenails at the idea that George Bush would be more than look, Charlie Black, McCain's advisor, he said McCain would benefit from another terrorist attack. And you know what? It's true. Because they waved the bloody shirt from September 11th, and they capitalized and prostituted the blood and bones and gristle and heartbreak and death of September the 11th to make it, and nobody seems to ask, hey, you know, well, you know, they were fighting the terrorists because of the worst attack on Americans, blah, 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 blah. And nobody looks up and goes, hey, the worst attack in American history happened on that dumb weasel's watch. Why won't he take responsibility for it?
Because it was because Clinton wouldn't, like, retaliate for coal and embassy and, like, all this other crap, and he was bombing aspirin factories.
Bingo.
That's the response I always get.
So the Democrats are scared to death that George Bush might just look the other way like he did with the presidential daily briefing of August 6, 2001 and let something happen. And then, well, you see, if the craven cowardly Democrats who want to appease the terrorists hadn't stopped FISA, we would have heard that this was going to happen and we could have prevented it, but the Democrats killed America. Tell me they wouldn't do it.
They would, but you kind of got me thinking about another point here. I'm in a class with about 18 other people right now. And I don't know if this is somewhat related to the point I'm going to attach it to, but I think it may be. We were discussing in class about, I don't even know how the subject came up, but we were discussing something in class. And the way our building is set up is we have basically one security officer on the premises. And there's like four entrances. Now all the doors are secure and you can only get in with an ID badge and da 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 and all this stuff. But when did everybody get to be so paranoid about just walking out somewhere and getting their head blown off? I mean, I've heard nothing but complaints in my class about the security situation. And, you know, well, some guy, and invariably, this is why I'm thinking it kind of links, because invariably, well, if some guy wants to go all terrorist on us, or somebody wants to go all, you know, they always link you with the whole terrorist thing, and I'm thinking, oh my God, all right, we are getting even so scared of each other. This is getting crazy. You know, they're not really.
That's why I coined that phrase, Vince, the coward nation. Not C-O-W-A-R-D, C-O-W-E-R-E-D, the coward nation. We are coward.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand that, you know, you do have the workplace shootings that have happened, you know. And there can be an argument made they happen more often now than they used to. The reason for that, I don't think is debatable, but we'll just say for the sake of argument that it's debatable. I think I know why it happens, but that's an entirely different subject for an entirely different time. But the simple fact of the matter is, you know, I was always raised to believe that, you know what, you get up in the morning, you put your shoes on, you go out the door, and you know what? You might get hit by lightning right then. You might walk across the street and get run over by a car. And you know what? Yeah, some crazy person who's having a bad day might just decide to pull out a Glock and shoot you, and you might not be able to do anything about it. But you can't live like that.
No, you can't. No, you can't. And you can't you can't walk around wondering when Osama's going to get you.
Exactly.
Because if you do that, you have to wonder when the lightning's going to get you. You have to be scared of the medication you take in the morning. You have to be scared of the food you eat, the water you drink, the car you drive, the car the other guy's driving, and pretty soon you are utterly immobilized by fear.
Exactly. And, I mean, don't get me wrong. There is nothing wrong with taking precautions. Look both ways across the street. And you know what? Yes, the argument could be made that maybe the security in the building I'm in right now isn't the best. But rather than being rational about it and just saying, well, that means I need to be a little more careful about my personal security, and maybe going to, you know, some guy higher up in the building and saying, hey, I have concerns. They're sitting there going, oh, my God, what if, oh, my God, oh!
Yeah, I know. And, you know, look, you're scared of lightning? Don't stand out in the middle of a golf course with your 9-iron sticking straight up in the air, okay? Just get out. Right. Or your metal tennis racket or graphite or whatever, get off the court, okay? Do rational things. Don't poke people who hate you in the eye with a sharp stick, i.e. occupying Iraq and talking about bombing Iran. But that is way too nuanced and way too complicated for the right-wingers and conservatives who generally have a meat locker temperature IQ.
Ugh.
I know. Hey, Vince, I got to roll along, brother. I'm running out of show.
You're giving them too much credit. Get them more blinkies.
Take care, Vince.
Oh, real quick, before I let you go,
yeah.
I couldn't get into the chat room. I sent a message to Sue, haven't gotten a response back. I tried to get into the chat room to say, hey, nobody, I couldn't get in.
Should be able to link right into it just through the headonradionetwork.com site.
I did, and Internet Explorer is throwing errors, and Firefox won't load it at all.
Okay, by the way, if you get that stupid phishing warning, there's no phishing on the site, by the way.
I know.
Oh, Jesus, Microsoft.
It is security settings. I whitelisted the site, and it's still ain't helping. Go ahead and get your blinkies. I just wanted to make you aware.
All right, take care, Vince.
No problem. Bye, Bob. Thanks
Bye,
a lot.
Our buddy Vince calling from the wilds of the Deep South. It's about 9 minutes before, 9 minutes before the end of the program. A couple of things just to throw out there. Sorry, got to do this. Know you hate it. I hate it too. But we are for the month at about a little more than $300 in contributions. That ain't good. That does not bode well for August. We'll get through July, but it doesn't bode well for August. I'm sorry. We hurt every month. We scrape and we scramble, and we haven't made our $2,000 a month goal in so long I can't remember when we did. That first law of holes I was talking about with Phil Graham, when you're in one, quit digging. Well, this is one hole we can't quit digging. We're in it. And we're not going away. We're doing everything in our power not to go away. But if you have the wherewithal, and if you are not entirely crushed by what this pea-brained, jug-eared, pig-eyed little lout has done to the American economy, and you value conversation radio, I simply and humbly ask you to contribute. If you've never contributed before, please do. If you haven't contributed in a while, and you can, get back with us. And if you are one of the regulars, know that you are all that stands between what you tune in for and what you download for, and absolute silence. It's that simple. Now, a last story before we quit. And by the way, the PayPal buttons are at headonradionetwork.com. If you don't do PayPal, the address, the snail mail address, is 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, P as in Paul, M as in Mary, B as in boy, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. That's how the snail mail gets to us. And frankly, just so you'll know, we've had to do some technical upgrades here that couldn't be avoided. We've had a bunch of thunderstorms. We got zapped and had to replace a bunch of uninterruptible power supplies. They're not free, not for the amount of stuff that it takes to make this happen. And they're not cheap either. You buy cheap, you get fried. So, you know, that took an outlay. We're upgrading equipment. We're upgrading computers. None of this is frivolous. This is all in an effort to keep all of this going. So know how important you are when you contribute. Know how important you are when you help us build the audience base so that we can continue this conversation. New listeners every day. And it's largely on account of you and your efforts. One last story. One last story to leave you with before we transition to the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio program, Strictly Confidential with Peter Godbold. You know all those support the troops, magnetic yellow ribbons that are made in China that are on the back of the gas-guzzling SUVs? You know all the support the troops that gets hollered by the right wing? I saw this one and I couldn't leave it alone. There's no time to really let it sink in real good, so that'll just have to happen after the show. The White House is currently threatening to veto new legislation that would, sit down, provide housing assistance to poor veterans. The White House says the bill is well-intentioned but flawed. It would make rental vouchers available to homeless vets. It would create a new position at the Department of Housing and Urban Development to deal with veterans' issues. It would provide assistance to private nonprofit groups to expand housing for low-income veterans. And the White House says it's flawed. You want to know what the flaw is in the bill? You listen to Wayne, this is going to drive you crazy, my brother. The Bush administration's gripe with the bill is that prevailing wage requirements under the Davis-Bacon Act would be applied to the construction of units funded by the legislation. That means paying a living wage to the construction workers who build the houses and build the apartments for veterans who are at present homeless. They get a living wage, and the White House objects to a living wage for people building houses for vets who don't have a home. I don't know what you're going to kick, but I'm going to kick something. Mark Levine said yesterday, you know, only 6 more months, Bob, only 6 more months. And I asked during my show last night, who gets sacrificed for the 6 months? Well, there's some of your sacrificial victims. The troops that the Bush administration so vociferously claims to support, all because George Bush and a bunch of godforsaken, soulless, motherless repiglickens hate union labor, hate decent wages, hate working people who have health care, hate working people who have pensions that allow them to retire with some level of dignity. For that, out of that hatred, they will sacrifice homeless vets. So it's quitting time. Many thanks to Peter Godbold and John Fox, respectively, our IT professional and our chief engineer. Thanks to the hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Almost finished with his fundraiser, he says. Thanks, everybody who has helped Ben along. He has been in real need. He never sends a bill for what he does to make sure that the horn programming goes out whenever and however people want it. He almost single-handedly saved liberal talk as it is with the White Rose Society, whiterosesociety.org. Many thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Go there. Stand shoulder to shoulder with the people who are fighting for all America to end the plague on this nation that is mountaintop removal. You may not think you have any connection to mountaintop removal, but brother, sister, you are downwind and downstream. Coal River Mountain Watch knows that, and they need your support too. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.